I'd like now to introduce Richard Block. He is the director of a play called Handy Dandy, which is opening Thursday, August 13th. And it's a production of Santa Fe Performing Arts. And actors Lois Viscoli and Jonathan Richards join us. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for having me. Oh, nice to be here. Oh,
it's good to have you all back, all long, many-time veterans of the Radio Cafe. So Handy Dandy, it's called A Comedy Butt by William Gibson. What's it about, Richard?
Oh, dear. But listen, I'm going to tell you, but I do want to take this moment because you can't do it, and I want to do it, to congratulate you, Mary Charlotte, on being named the number one, Radio Cafe being named the number one local program in Santa Fe.
Congratulations.
Congratulations to you. And
yes.
Also,
and KSFR,
and KSFR
News at
Noon. Because News at Noon was named number two. But that's a great honor, and you deserve it.
Thanks. So let's talk about the play.
Yes. Handy Dandy was written, William Gibson, who also wrote Two for the Seesaw and A Miracle Worker and other pieces, was a scholar as well as a playwright. And he wrote this, I'm told, for a convention originally, to be performed at a convention for peace activists. It's set in Boston in a court in 1983, which is important to know because the language and, you know, like the salaries, everything that's in it, you know, goes back to the 1983. So what are we talking about? What, 20-some years ago, 26 years ago? It deals with really, it's sort of it's a very humorous, there's a lot of real, there are great characters, two great characters. One is this judge, a district court judge, which is, of course, being played by Jonathan, and Molly Egan, who is an older sister of a Catholic order in Boston, and she is early 70s, and she is brought into court for trespassing at a nuclear facility or nuclear corporation that makes these bombs. And it's an argument, in a way, of a moral argument written brilliantly. I mean, Gibson is quite a remarkable writer, and it's written by him about the slow convergence of these two personalities into a certain kind of affection, but both of their positions kind of remain the same. She, of course, is the moral spokesperson, and he is the legal of the law and how jurisprudence should be dealt with. And it's a very, it's unique in a way to me because it's an argument, it's a very intelligent, provocative, challenging argument, but at the same time it's extremely entertaining.
It reminds me of Antigone in the sense this question of what's right versus what's
a very good analogy, with the argument in that, which is an argument also. But it's not as funny.
Right.
Antigone's not as funny.
No. It reminds me a lot of Shaw from a certain point of view, in that we're dealing with the world of ideas and how they are exhibited by these two people. But with humor. And also with the great added thing that the characters are so fascinating and interesting, as only a very good playwright can manage.
It does have some Shavian wit, definitely.
Definitely, and the whole idea of ideas, you know, I mean, we are dealing with very basic, important ideas that we're experiencing now as we speak.
Exactly. I mean, these are questions that don't go away. I just ran into Mary Risley a couple of days ago, who's an activist who still does stuff just like this.
Exactly.
So tell us more about your character and the ideas that she is putting forward.
Well, she's an interesting character in that she not only is a nun, but she has lived a very full life before that. I mean, she's been married and so forth and has lived. She's, if you can excuse the expression, been around the block a couple of times. Before she was a nun, and so all of that feeds into her personality and how she sees the world. She's a realist. She's not just an idealist.
But she's also an activist in a very big way. She was, in fact, a communist in the
30s. Yes, exactly.
When a lot of people were before the Stalin-Hitler Pact,
exactly.
39, yeah.
And then there is Jonathan's character, the law.
Well, the judge is a practical person. He believes in the law and that moral issues should perhaps inform the law, but they should not inform the conduct of the law. They should inform the making of law. But once law is made, his belief is that if we're going to have an organized society, you need to rule according to the law and not according to emotion. So he's a stickler for that aspect and also for logic. He doesn't think that there is a real practical value to a couple of nuns carrying placards on the grounds of a nuclear facility. He thinks there are perhaps other ways of doing these things, but if what you're doing is breaking the law in a very sort of small potatoes way, it doesn't really accomplish much.
What is the crime that Lois's character is accused of?
Trespass. She is accused of specifically of trespassing on the grounds of the nuclear facility and not leaving when told to by the proprietors.
And because it's a nuclear facility and not a school playground, the stakes are higher?
Well, not really. Stakes might be higher in terms of what she's protesting, but in terms of the law, if she were picketing on somebody's front lawn, it would be much the same. The law would be the same.
If asked to leave, yes.
And so how does that, we don't want to give away too much of the play, but how does it develop? I mean, the whole thing really is just a two-person drama?
It's a two-person drama with a few offstage voices from other people in court and that sort of thing. But essentially the way it develops is that she keeps being hauled into court for the same offense, and a relationship develops between them, grudging on the part of, really on the part of both of them. Neither of them are each other's idea of a good time. But a respect develops, and a sense of responsibility develops on the part of the judge because of the things he has to do legally to follow the law.
And eventually he has a bit of a conflict, which is what sort of motivates and moves the play along, in that while he is a defender of, you know, the legal view, he can hear what her argument, and her arguments do affect him little by little and eventually. And what actually ends up with is a kind of affection for each other, a real, you know, a bond.
This is a piece that is certainly of a particular time and place. How is it dated, do you think, Richard, and how is it universal?
Well, I think it's dated in the very fact of the active demonstrating, which, of course, you don't see as much now of, you know, carrying placards on nuclear. You know, we don't see them at the Los Alamos lab, you know, parading back and forth all the time. It's that way. And just certain, I don't know, other things like just numbers. I mean, you know, salaries, costs of things, which we chose not to change because it's set in 1983. And to try to change that changes the whole timbre of the thing.
I think we probably could have made the changes and brought it up to date, but in a way I think there's a value to showing that things that people were concerned about a quarter of a century ago are things that people are still concerned about now.
Exactly.
We have Obama recently once again affirming his commitment to reducing the stockpiles of nuclear weapons and saying it may not happen in my administration or my lifetime, but we've got to start working toward it, and I think that that's something that's very much in the minds of a lot of people still.
You see, I brought you this artwork, which is, there will be these panels. It's said, it's mentioned in the play, these two visions of power and authority.
This is radio, Richard. Radio.
I know, I'm describing it.
He's about to describe this very
one is
nice artwork we have before.
One is Zeus with his
spear?
Thunderbolt, and it's a spear.
It'll
actually
be a spear.
Will be a spear of authority and justice and power, and the other is the Jesus figure, which will be, he'll be on the cross in our actual panels. But Jonathan has designed these and will be executing them, and we're very appreciative of that. And
one is red, the other is blue.
That's right, and they're on a background of white. So when we told the technical person that what kind of paint to say, I just used the colors of the flag.
It does go to the deepest issues that we have before us as human beings, namely the nature of power. What does it even mean that the meek shall inherit the earth? What does standing up for the right thing in the face of violent power do for anybody?
Of course. Civil disobedience is the very heart of protest and of change. If Gandhi had respected all the laws, things would have taken a very different turn in India if Martin Luther King Jr. had done nothing but respect laws. I mean, it's all about not non-violent protest and respectful breaking of laws in order to achieve moral ends.
One thing that we have right now is we do not have the Cold War anymore. We have the so-called War on Terror, which has kind of lost its appeal to the popular imagination to a large extent. But that holding up of an enemy is something from another time that really does bring us back to a whole different mindset.
And that's very definitely a very good point, because this play is set during the Cold War, and the Russians are a part of this, mindset. And so to update this would have to be changing all those things. And it's so, I don't understand updating anyway, as a director, theater director. But we chose not to, because it belongs where it belongs, and it works that way.
And in terms of the outfits, probably Nunwear hasn't really changed that much anyhow.
Well, it's interesting, because in the beginning she does wear a habit, as nuns do. But then since she works at a place called the Peace House, and they run a soup kitchen, she wears just plain clothes that she's picked up in sales and rummage sales and so forth.
Except when she goes clamming.
Yes.
In her habit.
Right. But she doesn't wear a habit throughout the play, which I think is interesting, because I think they don't today either, to a great extent. They wear normal clothes, although they don't look provocative in any way, but they're simple. But you never forget the fact that she is a nun.
But even when she's wearing her habit, she's wearing tennis shoes.
Yes.
and that the habit was outdated even at the time of the play. There's some dialogue referring to the fact that where the Duchess says, "Oh, I haven't seen one of those in years." And so she's a nun who takes being a nun very seriously. To wear the habit at all in the game.
Right, and she gets that from Vatican too. The meeting there. When they said, get the church out into the world. And that's exactly what she takes as her principle, and she does.
But even with her seriousness about the order, she, like Sister Teresa, or Mother Teresa, Mother Teresa, she has a lot of trouble with faith.
Oh, yes.
A lot of it.
Oh, yes.
And it comes into play in this play.
I think probably it's fair to say that many or most thinking people do have trouble with faith, at least at times.
I absolutely agree, and I think they also obviously have trouble with power too, the legal power, and I don't know that it is resolved, but it makes for fascinating, interesting dialogue between the two.
Well, why is the play called Handy Dandy? We're talking, by the way, about a comedy, but ... by William Gibson, which is opening on Thursday, the 13th of August.
I'm so glad you asked, because it is a confusing title, because Handy Dandy, in today's vernacular, doesn't really mean what it meant when, in the quote that Gibson picks up to use. The quote is from King Lear. And we use it on all of our publicity, and we'll be in the program because people need to see it in order to put the play into some kind of framework. It says, change places, and handy dandy, which is the justice, which is the thief? And I don't know what handy dandy meant to him. Maybe Jonathan knows.
I think that you could just say presto change-o or something like that. It really, it's just a rhyming phrase that means, there you have it. It has no more significance.
Or which is which, or what is what. And that's really what the play is about, which is justice, which is thief. But it's done with such wit and beautiful writing and such cleverness.
Well, I think when you take these heavy themes and imbue them with, first of all, realistic characters and humor, it makes it much easier for people to think about them and talk about them.
Exactly.
You can come and have a good time.
And then go home and have something to talk about.
And hopefully, I would guess that would be the end result of seeing this play. It certainly would be if I saw it. I'd say it would engage me in conversation with someone about just what is this play doing? You know, what did it accomplish? And you know, what are these people... Where do they go from here? You know, what does it mean?
We're hoping that people will come to blows in the lobby on the way out.
Is that really what you want,
that
Jonathan?
Is what we seek.
And a few laughs along the way.
We'll have signs made on each side of the argument that people can parade with. Are we allowed to give a phone number here?
Of course.
To people to call if they would like to make a reservation or...
Yes, I was going to just do that right now.
Thank you so much.
984-1370 is the number for reservations and information. The Santa Fe Performing Arts Adult Company presents Handy Dandy, a comedy butt by William Gibson, starring Lois Viscoli and Jonathan Richards, and Richard Block directing, all of whom are here with us. And it's Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, starting August 13th and running for 2 weekends. And then Sunday, and that's at 7:30 in the evening. Sundays are at 2 in the afternoon, August 16th and 23rd. And once again, for reservations, 984-1370. And this is happening at the Armory for the Arts?
That's correct. On Old Pecos Trail.
On Old Pecos Trail, not far from the Center for Contemporary Arts. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mary
Charles.
It's been a joy.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR.